So most of you are dynamicists. I'm not. I'm not sure what I am, actually. But I will attempt. So much heckling already, and I haven't even said anything controversial. But I will attempt to pose some dynamical questions that I think are connected to the state of the Earth and the Earth-Moon system. And here they are, and I will list them again at the end of the talk to motivate the discussion. They're pretty obvious questions. The first one is the time scale of Earth formation. How long did it take to accumulate 90% of the Earth? How long did it take to accumulate 99% of the Earth? The second one has to do with the size spectrum of bodies colliding with the proto-Earth. We now have this view that most of the mass arrived in very big objects and provided giant impacts. But of course, the accumulation into runaway embryos, the giant impactors, is surely incomplete. And in addition, as in, for example, the work of Eric Asfalk, we expect to have some tidal disruption so that there is a process that makes small bodies, as well as the process that originally made the big bodies. And I'll explain how this has implications for the state of the Earth. The third question is the question of mixing. That is to say, to what extent is the material that goes into the Earth, material that originally condensed at small distances from the Sun, say half an AU, all the way out to objects from the Jupiter zone? And the last question listed here, which I will not talk about, but I include because it's an important one, is the question of the timing of the gas loss, since that will have consequences for the thermal state and perhaps the noble gas inventory of the Earth. When was the gas eliminated from the terrestrial planetary zone relative to the timing of the accumulation of the solid bodies?
You mean
the solar nebula? The solar nebula, yes. The connection between these questions and observations are as follows. The formation timescale is connected to a variety of isotopic systems, but I'm going to talk in particular about hafnium tungsten, and I'll explain that one in a few minutes. The second issue, which has to do with the relative importance of small and big bodies, is also linked, as you will see, to the hafnium tungsten story. But in addition, it's linked to what we think we understand about the composition of the Earth's core, the temperature of the Earth's core, and the extent to which Earth's mantle is layered. The mixing question can be addressed in a variety of ways, but I'm going to talk about it from the point of view of oxygen isotopes. And I'll give you my summary right now so that you know where I'm headed. The first two are actually not new statements. The third one is a new statement and therefore might be wrong. The first one is that hafnium tungsten does not necessarily provide the timescale for Earth formation. Some people are presenting it as a confirmation of dynamical ideas, and there's a danger of a bandwagon effect where the dynamicists say, oh yeah, the cosmochemists agree with us, and the cosmochemists are saying, oh yeah, we get the same thing as the dynamicists. But be careful. It doesn't necessarily provide the timescale for Earth formation, and in particular, you can have late, like say, 50 million year epoch, large impacts as part of the accumulation process of the Earth without violating the hafnium tungsten story. And I'll explain in what way that could be the case.
Dave, is there something special about 50 million years?
No, there's not. No. That's just a random. It could be 100. Mantle composition and core temperature don't give you a clear conclusion, but the most reasonable conclusion is that both large and small bodies were part of the Earth formation process. So we shouldn't just be thinking about giant impacts. We should also be thinking about the rather steady influx of smaller bodies as part of our story for what took place as the Earth formed. And the third point is that you could end up with similarity between Earth and Moon, as we see with oxygen isotopes, even if the body that came in and hit the Earth and made the Moon was isotopically distinct For example, Mars itself. What if Mars itself, a body identical to Mars, came in and hit the Earth? Could you then get similar isotopic character for Earth and the Moon? And I think the answer is maybe, and I'll explain that. First, a little bit of philosophical introduction about the way you should think about these problems. How should you think about a planet? We can think about a planet in terms of provenance, where did the stuff come from, just in the same way as you would talk about the particular characteristics of an apple from an apple tree in terms of the soil in which the tree grew. And in that sense, of course, we relate the Earth as an apple to the environment in which it grew. I want to remind you, but I will not talk about it very much, is there is, of course, the complementary viewpoint that you must think about the Earth as a machine which alters things through time, as, for example, a steam engine as invented by Hero way back in the first century AD. And, of course, you need to do both. A very brief summary of some important statements that we can make about the Earth. Most of the core is liquid and predominantly metallic iron. There are other elements in the core. We strongly suspect these days that among those elements there is silicon, and silicon is important because we think that it requires high temperature and perhaps high pressure in order to go into the core. There is an inner core for the Earth, a solid central region, and the behavior of iron under pressure enables us to place a temperature estimate for the center of the Earth. And it's about the same as the temperature at the surface of the Sun. And this number will be important for my story. It's quite a large number. Somewhat more controversially, both geochemists and seismologists are now, after decades, converging on a viewpoint that there is some mantle layering, that the mantle is not the same throughout. It might only be the bottommost part of the mantle, the region that seismologists call D double prime, that's distinctive. And it's of interest to my story because it's quite possible that this layer, this separate region, is primordial, that it was produced as the Earth formed. The context of my story is a standard one, which I don't need to elaborate for people in this audience. We're thinking of a terrestrial planet formation story in which you rapidly make small bodies which may differentiate through aluminum 26 heating. And in fact, through runaway accretion, you make objects the size of the Moon or even Mars in this same epoch of order of a million years, so that these objects too could differentiate through aluminum 26 heating. And then, of course, through orbit crossing, you have this longer time scale of 10 to perhaps as much as 100 million years, where you grow the large planets, including the Earth. And this last stage is presumed to be in the absence of the solar nebula, on the basis of astronomical indicators of the time scale of losing the gas. And in this picture, the people who play this game find that there's mixing from various regions of initial accumulation from the original locations of the embryo, so that the bodies that go into making the Earth come from a variety of distances from the Sun. Some important numbers to keep in mind when you think about the Earth. The energy of Earth formation, gravitational energy of Earth formation, expressed in temperature units is 40,000 degrees. More relevant, perhaps, is the dimensionless number constructed from the energy of Earth formation scaled to the latent heat of vaporization for rock. That's of order unity. In other words, there's enough energy when you make the Earth to vaporize the Earth. The reality, of course, is that a lot of this energy is eliminated by radiation. And another important thing to keep in mind is that if you were to radiate away all of the energy of Earth formation steadily over 10 to the 8 years, the Earth would only have to be 400 Kelvin. So this is making a very different statement from this, but it's a reminder of the important role that infrequent large impacts plays in setting up the initial conditions for the history of the Earth. And the last statement is that the energy of Earth formation is 10 times greater than all of the radioactive energy created, integrated right through geologic time. And this tells you, of course, that the formation process and the core formation process are the most important events in the history of the Earth. And giant impacts, of course, are an important part of this process because it comes out of the dynamical simulations, and these events are, of course, truly extraordinary. After an event where you hit the Earth with an object the size of Mars, the Earth will radiate like a low-mass star for of order 1,000 years, meaning effective temperature of order 2,000, 2,500, maybe even 3,000. As part of this process of accumulation, you make a magma ocean. The outer region of the Earth is completely molten. For a short period of time following a giant impact, it may be molten all the way through to the core. But more typically, one has a state where the deeper part of the mantle is frozen but very hot because of the effect of pressure. When you squeeze things, starting in a liquid state, they get hotter when you squeeze them adiabatically, but they also freeze because the melting curve has a stronger dependence on pressure than the adiabat. So the burial of accretional energy prevents immediate re-radiation. A chill crust may form. There may also be a steam atmosphere. And the lower mantle can easily freeze because of pressure, and this limits the depth, so that often people in a quasi-steady state picture talk about magma oceans of order 500 kilometers thick. Following a giant impact, and maybe even at other times as well, one has therefore a picture of a magma ocean which is starting to crystallize due to pressure. It's vigorously convecting. Convection over 10 times of days to weeks to months. It can stay well mixed, but in the deeper region where it starts to freeze, there will be a difference in density between liquid and solid. The liquid quite possibly will be iron rich, not as a metal, but as oxidized iron. That material may accumulate down towards the core mantle boundary, and that may be the origin of the D-double prime layer that the seismologists see. And indeed, it is now quite popular to talk about a layered mantle. It doesn't come from the magma ocean, but it comes from the stage as the magma ocean freezes due to percolative flow, the liquid migrating through the crystal mesh. It might be eliminated later by Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities and thermal convection, but very possibly you end up with a state that looks something like this, and this is one possible cartoon for the present Earth from the work of Louise Kellogg and colleagues. That's controversial, actually, but I'm now going to say something that is relatively uncontroversial in this game, and that is something called core superheat. Remember, I told you that we know the temperature of the Earth's core, and we know it because we know the melting curve of iron at high pressure, and we know that the inner core of the Earth is solid. And so you can talk about where the temperature of the Earth is and where it might have been when the Earth first formed, and there has to be a cooling of the Earth over geologic time, since otherwise you cannot generate the Earth's magnetic field. So this core superheat turns out to be of order 1,000 degrees or more, and by superheat I mean what petrologists and volcanologists mean by superheat, which is the temperature excess, more strictly entropy excess, relative to the state you would have if you just took the liquid at its melting point and compressed it adiabatically. So here is the liquid iron that you might have thought you had in the early Earth in the mid-mantle. You compress it adiabatically and you end up at a temperature here in the core which is much cooler by 1,000 degrees or more than what we believe you must have had in the early core, and in fact at least 500 degrees cooler than the actual temperature of the core, which is shown here. This is diagnostic of the core formation process. It tells you that there was a traumatic process as the core formed. It very likely is an indicator of the giant impact story, at least in part, because in these giant impacts, you get severe heating, as Robin Canup showed in her simulations this morning. That heat does not easily get out. It is there stored. Part of that heat in the core is probably a legacy of the moon-forming event. And indeed, in the picture, as Robin talked about this morning, one imagines an impact that splashes material into Earth orbit. The moon forms from a disk in 100,000 years, something like that. And one gets this picture that Robin and others have worked on, and Bill may talk about more, which involves one moon in a nearly equatorial orbit near the Roche limit, which then tidally evolves outwards. All of that is background. Now I'm going to tell you about hafnium tungsten, and then I'll tell you about oxygen isotopes. So what's the hafnium tungsten story? There is an isotope of hafnium, hafnium-182, which decays to tungsten-182 with a half-life of 9 million years. Tungsten is core-loving, meaning that it's siderophile. It likes to go into the iron that goes into the core. So if you have liquid iron around, it will grab the tungsten. Hafnium is not. It stays in the crust and mantle. Imagine, if you will, a fully mixed body of iron and silicate at some time zero, which then differentiates early on relative to this time scale into a core and a mantle. In such a picture, this particular isotope of tungsten will not have been made at the time that you differentiate. And so the hafnium that is still radioactive in this mantle region will then create this tungsten isotope, and you will then measure it in the rocks. And that is indeed what people see. I'm being simplistic in my description of this because the signature that they see is quite subtle and small and not as extreme as you would get if you differentiated at time zero. But indeed, people now agree that there is an observed excess 182. Of course, they ratio it to other tungsten isotopes, which are not the consequence of a decay process. On the other hand, if you did the separation late or formed the planet late, then there would be no excess, because in that picture, the core formation process would grab this tungsten, which would have already been created, and put it into the core. Implicit in this, of course, is the correct view, I believe, that the ability of these two reservoirs to chemically equilibrate after formation is negligible. You get diffusion across this boundary, but we're talking about thousands of kilometers. Diffusion is a very inefficient process, even in the presence of convection. And so you have to do this process of equilibration when you have an intimate mixture. So that then brings us to two extreme end members of thinking about the formation of a planet such as the Earth. Here is one end member, and in this end member we have these Moon or Mars-sized bodies that form early on and differentiate under the action of aluminum-26 heating, forming core and mantle. You then collide these objects together in a giant impact, and imagine that as a consequence of the collision process, all you're doing is merging the cores. Core merging means that this material does not equilibrate with this, and therefore that will be an instance where the time scale that the hafnium tungsten tells you about is this time scale, this early process, and it's not telling you anything about the formation of the Earth. That's one extreme. The other extreme, of course, is where the collision process still involves bodies that have differentiated, as in Robin Knapp's simulation, but in the collision you make a mess. You emulsify the material. That would be the other extreme. The emulsification means that these droplets are down at order of centimeters so that diffusion can happen between the iron and the silicate. You can re-equilibrate, suck up the tungsten, and then indeed the time scale given by hafnium tungsten would be the planet formation time scale. So what really happens? Well, Robin showed us a simulation, an example of a simulation this morning, and I now want to talk a little bit more in detail about what you can and cannot believe from these simulations. It is surely the case that most of the material is melted, part of it is vaporized. As Robin showed, the core of the projectile is often intact. It then crashes back into the Earth, it plunges to the core, it doesn't stay as a sphere, of course, you get severe distortion, but on a free fall time scale of hours, you get that core settling down into the pre-existing proto-Earth core, and you get core merging. The SPH does not indicate all that much direct mixing, but of course we have to ask ourselves the question, could it be that SPH is not capturing that? And of course SPH, because of resolution difficulties, is not going to pick up one obvious way in which iron and silicates can mix, and that is Rayleigh-Taylor instability. Here is the simplest picture of a Rayleigh-Taylor instability. Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities are interchange instabilities driven by differences in pressure gradients. But the simplest case to think about is quasi-hydrostatic, where you have heavy material on top of light. So here, for example, we have a liquid iron sphere falling through liquid silicate mantle, and the instabilities will occur at this interface, which is heavy over light. In general, of course, you have to do the calculation thinking about the actual pressure gradients, and the calculations I will tell you about do that. The picture of a Rayleigh-Taylor instability, therefore, is that if you have some interface with heavy over light, you have a G effective that's driving the instability that depends on the ratio of the density difference to density of one of the fluids. In this case, this is of order unity, so this is a very strong effective gravity driving this instability. You get rapid exponentiation of small-scale instabilities on the timescale literally of seconds for the parameters of interest in this problem. And you get a mixed layer that grows as square root of time in the nonlinear regime, where you get an emulsification of the iron and the silicates. And in fact, you get a Kolmogorov spectrum. The instabilities are being fed at small scale but grow to large scale given by the mixing distance. How do I know all this? It comes from the work of people who are interested in the equivalent oceanographic problem, which is salty water mixing with fresh water. This is a case where there's no immiscibility, so surface tension doesn't matter. But here's the development of an instability between salty water and fresh water. And this has been studied both in the lab at Cambridge, but also in numerical experiments by the same group. Fastest growing instabilities, as I said, at centimeters. The other important length scale is also of that order. It comes from surface tension. So in fact, you do get droplets of iron mixed in with the silicate at the centimeter length scale. The work I'm describing here has been done with Teisdale, who's a student at University of Copenhagen. Summarizing our results, we find after doing a boundary layer analysis that if you have a blob of iron sinking through liquid silicate, it basically gets eroded away. There's an instability at the interface that eats away and makes the sphere smaller, so it gets literally eaten away by this instability. And the mixing process, the erosion process, goes as this dimensionless number, G effective times the distance traveled over the velocity at which it's moving squared. For iron spheres, this means that the mixing is efficient for radii less than about 100 kilometers. So if I take a 100 kilometer blob of iron and drop it into a liquid silicate mantle, it will be completely eliminated. Mixing is at about the 10% level for radii of order 500 kilometers, negligible at 1,000. Now, of course, you don't have iron spheres, so that's where this problem gets very messy. And the aspect ratio does matter. You get sheets and filaments. But it does look as though if you have really large blobs that you're not getting very efficient equilibration. You're not getting the opportunity for all of the iron to re-equilibrate with all of the silicates. So in my opinion, it is quite likely that the hafnium tungsten story is not giving us the time of Earth formation, because part of the delivery of material to the Earth involves large impacting bodies where a significant amount of the iron simply does not have the opportunity to equilibrate with the silicate through which it goes. It gets heated, and that's an important part of the core superheat, but it doesn't chemically re-equilibrate. Now, in addition to that story, there is a well-developed geochemical story from the work of Ryder and Drake, and also Malcolm Walter and others, where they try and understand the composition of mantle rocks in terms of equilibration between iron and silicate in a quasi-equilibrium system where you have a magma ocean, a solidified lower mantle. And this is not a giant impact story. It's important for you to understand that. This is the picture that you might imagine between giant impacts. And it looks as though that's also an important part of the story, because when you look at the siderophile abundances in the mantle, what you see in mantle xenoliths, the rocks that we get from the mantle, is that there's a pattern of elemental abundances that suggests equilibration at this level, maybe 500 or so kilometers below the Earth's surface. The pattern is unlikely to be the result of giant impacts. It doesn't explain the core superheat, so the summary I'm giving you at this point is that we see a combination of two things happening here. One is evidence for a giant impact effect in the temperature of the Earth, evidence for small bodies in the siderophile abundance. It's not a clean picture, but it looks as though you need both. Let me now talk about oxygen isotopes. Shown here is the standard isotope plot. Oxygen has three stable isotopes, 16, 17, and 18 in mass. This is the anomaly of oxygen 17, the anomaly of oxygen 18. The trends here have sloped 1/2 and are the mass-dependent fractionations that we all know and love. But in addition, there are offsets of the trend of the meteorites from the Earth and Moon together and from Mars, represented by the SNCs. And Earth and Moon are indistinguishable on the scale, although they could differ slightly and you wouldn't know. This fundamental difference is not understood. I want to make it clear. I don't understand what it is. Nobody understands where it actually comes from. But we can use it as a diagnostic of mixing, even though we don't understand the fundamental origin of the differences. The similarity, the identity, if you will, of the Earth and Moon is often taken to imply that the material that came to us as the projectile producing the Moon had the same isotopic character as the Earth.
The size of the squares was the error in measurement on this plot.
Yes. Some of the Earth data are more accurate so that the line is more precisely defined than in this case.
Basically, you cannot see any error on Earth.
Relative to the scale that's shown in this graph. There is scatter, though. There is scatter, and there are some special instances of mass independent fractionation which complicate matters. There is a mass independent fractionation process that's known to happen in the Earth's atmosphere. That's a long and complicated story, but it's not relevant to what I'm presenting here. So here's the conjecture that I wish to give to you. And this is something I've only been working on for a week or so, motivated by Morby when he visited Caltech a couple of weeks ago. So I said to myself, what if the impactor that made the Moon had a mass about the mass of Mars and brought in an isotopic signature that I will call epsilon in some units, doesn't matter what the units are, where Earth, by arbitrary definition, is given the value zero and has a mass a little bit less than the final mass. So I'm bringing in an impactor hitting the Earth. Most of the impactor will merge with the Earth and therefore dilute the isotopic signature down to 0.1 of its original value, since only 10% of the mass came in with one unit of isotopic anomaly. And in order to explain the Earth-Moon system, I have to imagine that somehow I made a Moon, a mass that's only of order 1% of the Earth with an isotopic signature that is indistinguishable from the Earth, which in practice actually in these units means that it could still be a few percent different. So it doesn't have to be identical, but it has to be fairly close. How could you do that? So here's the picture that I'm suggesting, and I'm not sure that this works, but it's possible and doesn't seem to have been thought through before. Immediately after the impact, in the days, weeks, months after the impact, you form a liquid silicate disk. That's not new. That idea has been around for decades. But what I've been thinking about is the question, the possibility that this material can equilibrate isotopically and in other respects with the matter of the Earth through exchange across the liquid-gas interface of the disk, and in turn exchange across the interface between the liquid mantle of the Earth and the disk. The core is completely isolated in this process because it consists of immiscible fluid. In these models, you have a silicate vapor atmosphere radiating at about 2500 Kelvin, limited by the opacity that comes from condensation of silicate grains. This disk may exist for 100 to 1,000 years. The vapor pressure in this foamy interface here is at about 10 to 100 bars. This comes, by the way, this part is not new. This is from a model I published with Chris Thompson in 1989. You can then ask, what's the rate at which you transfer atoms, molecules, across the liquid-gas interface? And that exchange is limited by basically the vapor pressure divided by the sound speed, so you can work that out. For an equilibrated disk, hydrostatically equilibrated locally, and that time scale is of order a week, and it's aided by the fact that it's a two-phase medium, it's a foam. So the point is that this is quick. Exchange here means that all of the material in the silicate disk can exchange with the atmosphere, which is a significant fraction, maybe 10% the mass on that time scale. There are, in turn, convective timescales in the disk and in the mantle that are of order a week. And last but not least, there are convective timescales in the vapor part of the system that are of order days. In each case, this is calculated using the heat flow out of the system, which is about 10 to the power of 8 ergs per square centimeter per second, and using the standard mixing layer distance theory for convective vigor. So what I conclude from looking at these numbers is that because these numbers are less, although perhaps not a lot less, than the timescale for evolution of this disk, there is the possibility of taking a disk that originally has 0.8 in these epsilon units and diluting it down to 0.1 through exchange mediated by the vapor atmosphere. So I'm suggesting that oxygen isotope similarity between Earth and Moon might be an indicator of the exchange of material following a giant impact before this material has spread beyond the Roche limit and accumulated into planetesimals and built the Moon, as in the story of Ida and Knapp and others who have worked on this.
Dave, are you suggesting that you have a very efficient radial mixing in this reason?
I am not using radial mixing in the liquid part. In the atmosphere. I worry a little bit about doing it in the disk. I thought about that, but the disk may not be, certainly in the models I just did with Chris Thompson, the disk is actually not well connected to the Earth. They're at different rotation rates, so there's a boundary layer there. And it wasn't clear to me that you'd get efficient mixing by that method, so I wanted to use the intermediary of the gas disk, which is a significant fraction of the mass of the system. It wouldn't work, obviously, if it were a tiny fraction of the mass.
Then what about the conservation angle in this
atmosphere? I am not sure about that piece of the problem. You're right that because of the question of maintaining the angular momentum budget, you might worry about whether that gas can mix. So I'm just using a simple idea for the convective vigor as a guide for the timescale. But you're right, it may not work for that reason. So I'm not sure about that part of it. All of the silicates, essentially, and in particular the oxygen, can participate through very, this is high temperature, of course, so there's very rapid exchange of the isotopes, and the volatile component is probably the FeO, and so there's an equilibration of the oxidized iron in the system. So that's probably the main carrier. I would not, of course, use water. Water gets broken down and hydrogen escapes. So I've come to the end. This is my summary again of the points I made earlier. And I'll finish, therefore, by putting this back up because I know Morby and others will want to comment on some of these issues. So I'm hoping that this will motivate discussion on these questions. Thank you.
That was a very interesting talk. Let's proceed to questions. Pretty sure there will be quite a lot of them.
With regard to number two, the size spectrum of flying bodies, it's conceivable that you get enough grazing impacts and tidal disruptions near the end, and you have this large fragmentation tail that will be mechanically mixed with iron and silicates that end up on the Earth. And my question is, at what point do you get too much of that mixing that will ruin your
I think too much would be sort of more than 50%. So 50-50 would actually be okay. Why do I say that? Well, I still want to have a high temperature core, and I think the giant impacts help that. The smaller impacts do not. But I can dilute, I mean, there's so much heating that comes from the giant impact that I can sort of dilute that to a factor of two and I've still got superheat. So that's where the 50-50 is coming from. If it were a lot less than 50%, then I begin to worry about getting the siderophile pattern right. So I kind of like something like 50-50, but don't take that too literally. It could be 30-70, 70-30, you know. But I don't like 95-5 or 5-95. What do you think is the actual number? That's what I want you guys to tell me. I know Morby has an opinion on that. Well, what is the actual number? Of course, Morby hasn't done the tidal aspect, but yeah. You can tell us about the other aspect.
Our simulation is less than none. And so, first, in our simulation of just partials, the Earth builds only through wind. Then we have test particles which are massive. But we don't have the phenomenon of dynamical friction, which can change the numbers. But so, if we take our simulation of space values, and you assume that the small bodies have initially a mass equivalent to the total mass of the infant. It turns out that the Earth accretes 90% of its mass from the infant and 10% from the small body. The reason for it is that the small bodies get much more excited than the infant. Therefore, their collision probability for the Earth drops, but that thing is much more. Now, if we could include the dynamical friction, like there are some calculations for not really about that, for the moment we don't have the result. I think probably the result would even be more extreme, because the angles will be dynamically colder, and therefore the relative collision probability will increase. And the small bodies, because of the phenomenon of dynamical friction, will get even more excited. So I would say that 10% at most of the world mass comes from the bodies. They become so excited when they can like NEA, right? And NEA, even for 1 week, even NEA, then you have a week that an NEA, even NEA strikes the Earth. It's
have a caveat, that is, they're not creating new bodies.
That's it.
Yeah, but that's probably
they don't
not
count.
Just
and,
they don't count. Count. So there are multiple bases of all information.
What does the eccentricity what does the eccentricity of Earth's orbit tell us about this fraction? Anything? A lot? I'm asking you. I'm allowed to ask questions too. Hal or somebody?
Well, as you know, but I don't know how many people in the audience know, when we do these simple calculations of just starting out with embryos and letting them collide, it's very good at getting sort of the mass and semi-major axis of the Earth and Venus right. But the eccentricities are always too large. Right, so we're looking for ways of damping that eccentricity out, and the small bodies is a good way of doing that, right? But the calculations haven't been done yet.
Of course, that doesn't tell you whether those small bodies hit the Earth. It just tells you they're there, but presumably some substantial fraction have to hit the Earth.
But I think what Morby's calculations have shown is that if the small bodies are responsible for the drag, they're probably produced in impacts themselves, so probably have the composition of mantle. Not of the original.
Not undifferentiated small bodies.
That's
they
right.
They are fragments of giant pieces.
That's right.
They are pieces of the mantle. So
that's
they
right.
Are
yeah.
Undifferentiated small bodies as asteroids are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 I was going to ask the same thing. When you say small bodies, you mean bodies that are never differentiated, right?
Well.
Because they would retain the.
They may actually be differentiated. It depends when they formed. If you form an object that's a few 10 kilometers, a few times 10 kilometers in radius, and it's done very early, then it will differentiate through aluminum 26 heating.
Okay.
But if these things were produced in impact, they're pieces of the mantle. The iron was never there.
Yeah. That.
If.
Right.
Correct. If it's from a differentiated body, although I suppose it depends what kinds of. Disruption events you have in mind, but yeah
we've done some SPH modeling of embryo collisions, and like the most common outcomes are either merger or the two bodies inelastically bounce with a spray of mantle, and so the small bodies tend to be made of the mantle.
Mm-hmm.
Check.
In one of your cartoons about
the upper mantle, you said anything under 100 kilometers would be just spread out completely. And then as it goes into the lower mantle, which is solid, you'd have leaky diapirs.
Yeah.
Now, how leaky are those? I mean, it doesn't seem like they could be that leaky with your journey to the center of the Earth geoship. And in particular, the relevance to the problem is, do you mix up over geologic time the solid and the upper and lower parts of the mantle in as defined here? And therefore, if you completely get rid of the tungsten in the upper part and don't completely drain it out of the lower part, can you explain the difference even with a late impact?
Well, the thing you're asking about is something we don't know, unfortunately, and that is the extent to which you can have percolation in this medium. My guess is that you don't actually have a lot of percolation. A lot of the numerical simulations that have been done in recent years for blobs ascending like this suggest that you might channelize the flow, which means that you don't get chemical equilibration. The material is ascending too quickly, and in macroscopic fluid channels or blobs, so that you don't equilibrate between these two. But I have to admit that we don't know that for sure. That would be true, by the way, with a crack also. Material going through a crack would move so fast that it does not have the opportunity to chemically equilibrate. You know, sort of a meter across, the equilibration time actually depends more on the diffusion in the neighboring rock, and that's very, very slow, even if it's partially molten. So I would not rely on that. I think we have to indeed imagine in this kind of cartoon that the equilibration is occurring up here and not down in this region.
And that region will mix up.
This region may already be differentiated because of the earlier period of time when this part was also molten after a giant impact. So this part may not actually mix up completely, but it may just be the lowermost layer of a few hundred kilometers that is not participating, and all of the other stuff will mix.
But will that part that doesn't participate mix so that you could ultimately get the tungsten signature that we see, even though you had the upper part re-differentiate
Well, there are two issues here. One is theoretical, one is observational. The observational fact is that this particular isotopic system is remarkably stable no matter what rocks you measure. So there's no indication of separate reservoirs in the Earth in respect of this isotope. Although I must say there was one instance of material associated with a plume where people thought they were even sampling the core, but that's very controversial. So observationally, it seems as though it's a well-mixed reservoir in respect of that isotopic system. From a theoretical standpoint, unfortunately, it's hard to say with any certainty what would happen.
About the formation around the moon and these isotopes, if I looked at Robin's simulations, I thought at least half the matter in the disk actually came from the Earth's mantle rather than from the impactor. That's not true?
Because more like 80%.
Sort of green dots both in the mantle of the Earth and in the mantle of the impactor. Okay.
I should say, by the way, that although I did this in the context of the oxygen isotope story, I realized when I started doing it that this actually has implications for something that geochemists have been bothered about for a long time, which is that a lot of geochemists want to make the moon-forming material more like the Earth. And although I did this in terms of isotopes, it will also apply to damn near everything. The one exception being that the core really is isolated. That's why I put that little message in there. And the reason why the core is isolated is because it's immiscible, and the diffusion across that interface is just simply not fast enough, even though both reservoirs are convecting. The other part of the system, the liquid silicates, is fundamentally different because it's a foam. It's a two-phase medium with lots of surface area of contact between liquid and gas. So that's why you can equilibrate you might be able to equilibrate the material that makes the moon with the material in the Earth's mantle in every respect. And that is something that some geochemists would like, quite separate from the oxygen isotope story.
One complication to the disk story that I'm curious about is that if you have the moon sitting right there with a mass that's comparable to the disk mass, that, am I right?
Well, the disk might be a factor of two greater. Depends what you think about the process of angular momentum redistribution.
Right. So, so it's being repelled by the moon by disk tides, right? So, you could imagine a situation where you would dump the disk onto the Earth in a type 1 migration timescale.
Yeah. So one possible failure of this model is that out beyond the Roche limit, you're very quickly condensing moonlets, which then aggregate to make the moon on an even shorter timescale than I'm doing my re-equilibration. Then indeed you would be in trouble. And then you dump all of this disk back onto the Earth and you've lost. Now, I can't do these calculations with sufficient confidence in terms of the numbers that I'm talking about here to know whether it'll work or not. But it's clearly a situation where you can't be sure. Just a possibility. Calculation's only a week old. Yeah, that's right. That's right. It was done in real time.
So would you interpret the tungsten age of the moon to be the timing of differentiation in the impactor rather than the giant impact?
It could be, in which case the giant impact could be later than what some people are saying. Now, there are other, as you probably know, there are other isotopic indicators on this that people use, which sort of say that it might be nice to do it at, say, a fairly early time. So it's not just the hafnium tungsten. So there might be other indicators that require it to be early. But you could also wonder whether that was the last giant impact. Was it really the last giant impact? We don't know.
Any more questions? I have a question about...
What?
Okay. Thanks. I have a question about this. Right now in the simulations, you already can resolve particles at which you have this efficient mixing happening. As far as I remember, Robin was talking about 300 meter particles, right? Kilometer particles, right? And this is the size sort of at which you have this efficient mixing between the sinking blobs and the surrounding material. Right.
Yes.
So, do these blobs sinking in collection of several particles in the simulations, or are they sinking like a single particle?
I think a lot of them are settling in aggregate. Although in the particular simulation I gave that I showed, and I'm not sure it's the same one that you showed this morning, it's not really blobs. It's like a sheet. Like a very thick filament that sort of drains into the core, is that right?
Yeah, it's sort of wrapped around the core.
So,
but the width of that filament is much more than a single SPH particle.
But is it then correct to assume that they are spherical as you did in your calculation?
No, or, of course not. I did a sphere because I'm a theorist. And
okay, then you... Okay.
You got to start somewhere. There are also Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, although they appear to be less significant. But in the case of these filaments, Kelvin-Helmholtz can compete with Rayleigh-Taylor.
Well, I'd like to change the subject a little bit in the discussion and ask your opinion on where the water on the Earth came from and whether the Earth accreted wet or dry, because the cosmochemists seem to give me different answers every time, depending on who I talk to.
Well, Moby, of course, has an opinion, but Moby is engaged in another discussion. I will give you the standard line, which I think most of you know, which is that whatever you think about the timing, it does not seem likely that the water came from comets because it has the wrong D to H. Now, that doesn't really answer your question, but it needs to be said up front. that you therefore no longer have this idea that some people had that the Earth started out dry. I think that from the geological perspective, it seems quite clear that Earth had water early on. John Valley has this work on detrital zircons, which from Australia and date back to 4.3, 4.4 years, billion years. And that's conventionally interpreted, probably correctly interpreted, as arising from an environment where water was present, probably an ocean even. So it seems quite likely that the early Earth had an ocean. I think it's entirely reasonable to have as part of the material that accumulated during the main phase of Earth accretion for that to include the water that we have.
There's no problem about the fact that the iron in the Earth's core is not stopped?
No problem, because in fact what happens in the magma ocean phase is that hydrogen is soluble in iron and water is not at the pressures of relevance. So the iron happily takes up the hydrogen, and hydrogen is a very nice thing to have in the core. So there's no difficulty from that point of view. You have to remember, of course, that water is a minor carrier of oxygen. The most common atom in the Earth is oxygen. It's mostly in silicates. And yes, the water affects the fugacity, but it's not dominating the story. So it's perfectly okay to have water in the magma ocean. I should make one other point about this. When people talk about Earth's water, they're talking about a reservoir that we don't actually know. We have a lower bound, of course, which is Earth's oceans plus the component that we know must be there from looking at mid-ocean ridge basalts. And that's actually smaller than the Earth's ocean, but not by much. So we're talking about maybe two Earth oceans at least. But it might be 10. Might even be 100 Earth oceans worth, with a lot of it being in the core. We don't actually know the reservoir, and so there is still that question of which may be linked to the dynamical issue of where it came from. How much do we actually have? Unfortunately, we don't really know.
Okay, I think it's time to go, and let's thank David again. And